Live from Burbank, California, a product of the No City Left Behind Act. It's the Marc Maron Show. And now, he does a funny dance. Marc Maron!
Wow, that was an imaginative one. A funny dance. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, you're welcome, man.
Hey, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, art heads and dilettantes, welcome to the show. Welcome to the big Tuesday show, my friends. We got a big one today. We got director of the new film Art School Confidential, Terry Zweigoff, will be here with us in a minute. From the Band of Brothers, the political support organization for veterans running for Congress, Mike Lyon will be here a little later in the show. Columnist from the LA Weekly and The Nation, Mark Cooper, is going to be here to talk about Iran, immigration, the leaking White House. I'm looking forward to talk to him. He's going to be here later in the show. And then my buddy, singer-songwriter and comic Henry Phillips will be in the studio to do some funny. But right now, I just want to say a lot has happened in the world today, and we don't want to be caught uninformed or off guard here at the Marc Maron Show. So here's tonight's Marc Maron Show short order news. NASA plans to crash a space probe into the moon in 2009, a collision so violent it will be visible on Earth through a telescope. Since the mission does involve a crash, NASA has vowed to do their best to keep teachers off of it. In Wisconsin, a 25-year-old man convicted of stealing hundreds of pairs of underwear was sentenced on Friday to 1 year in jail for his second conviction of stealing panties. As part of his sentencing, the perp will have to go to sex offender counseling, but after his year in jail, he'll have to go to rape survivor counseling. President Bush's job rating has reached a new low. The survey found that 38% of the public approves of the job Bush is doing, down 3 percentage points due to the disappointment. Can I get through this joke? Why don't we start all over again? How about that, Jim?
Go ahead. Try
all
it
right,
over.
Thanks, man. President Bush, his job rating has reached a new low. The survey found that 38% of the public approved of the job Bush is doing. That's down 3 percentage points due to disappointment support. You know what's wrong with it? It's written all screwy. It's all written screwy.
Here, you want me to deliver it?
No, I'm going to do it. The survey found that 38% of the public approved of the job Bush is doing.
Oh, man, now, you're screwing up again.
Stop it. They approved of what he's doing, and that's down 3 percentage points due to disappointed supporters who don't think he is being racist enough.
That's damn hilarious.
Oh, now what are we going to do with that? That's Marc Maron's short order news for today. And you can end the music anytime. We are off to a great start, man. I'll tell you. What a day it's going to be,
oh,
Jim.
Man. This show is jam-packed with guests.
I think we're on the verge of World War III. I think that this standoff between the United States and Iran is going to lead China to bomb us. Hey, that's great. Let's bring on the guest. The film Crumb, about Robert Crumb, is one of the best documentaries ever made, in my opinion. Terry Zweigoff made that film and went on to make Ghost World, Bad Santa. And now his new film, Art School Confidential, is going to open around the country on May 5th. It's about a freshman at art school who is willing to do almost anything to win the heart of the studio model he's obsessed with. That's a feeling I'm familiar with. Along the way, the film satirically nails the entire art world, from students to dilettantes to teachers to professional artists to gallery owners to failures. This is Zweigoff's second collaboration with the genius comic artist Daniel Klaus, the first being Ghost World. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thank you.
I'm very happy you're here. I tell you, you know, I don't know if it's everyone's experience, but, man, I knew everyone in your film, and you just clobbered the affectations of the art school, of the hipster world, of just about everything I called my growing up period. Is that what you set out to do?
Oh, I don't know. I never went to art school myself, so I just set out to not embarrass myself like I try to set. That's my goal in every film that I start, not to embarrass myself.
That's my goal in life. I think I meet you. Why is that weird, though? Because I've had since I was a kid is that the idea of being embarrassed is more frightening than dying.
That's right. It is.
But, you know, if you think about it, if you sort of are caught off guard by death, that could be very embarrassing as well. But I guess we're not really planning on really knowing that.
Well, I was just talking at lunch with somebody who's telling me to take out assisted living insurance.
Oh, my God.
I'm looking into that. I'm getting old.
I mean, I'm one of those people. I don't know. I think that if it came down to that, as opposed to assisted living or losing my mind, perhaps we should just tell somebody to end it for us in a dignified way and not tell anybody.
That's right.
So I certainly respond in my life to the work of Robert Crumb and Daniel Klaus. I think they're great, and they change the way I perceive it. Now, what draws you to them exactly?
Well, in terms of working with them, you know, I've actually written a couple screenplays with Robert Crumb back in the 80s, but they never got made. But mm-hmm. what drew me to both of them was how good they are with dialogue, really, although I feel the same way you do about Robert Crumb. He really did change my way of seeing the world. He's really a sort of a genius in his own right. I know he's one of the great artists of the 20th century. That's why I made that film about him. But, people have this miscomprehension that I'm a big comics fan. I really don't know too much about other comic book artists or comics.
Well, I can tell just by the work of those two guys in particular is that they seem to have an almost pathological attraction to the sad, bitter reality that is life if you look at it in the right way.
And very similar sensibilities.
Right.
We became friends very quickly. And I met Robert. It took us about two meetings to become pretty close friends. About the same thing with Dan.
Yeah, and is it that I think it's interesting that you don't see people that have the guts to really to go into that kind of existential despair, and I wouldn't call it a pessimism, but maybe a cynical way of approaching the world, because I think that's where some of the best comedy is. But it makes a lot of people uncomfortable.
Well, I don't know if it takes guts, but it's just something it's the only way you can express yourself. There's not much choice to it. A lot of people think I have integrity in the film business. It's just like, it's largely, better things you just can't force yourself to do and other things that you can handle.
I so identify with that, because I was just saying the other day, because I do stand-up, and I sometimes find myself jealous of people that can just talk about nothing. And I am just incapable of it. If it is not a pressing problem for me or completely self-centered, I just do not know how to identify with it. You know what I mean? It's like people are like talking about the world.
I certainly identify with what you just said.
It's like the world. The world is my head, and I'm having a hard time living it. When I get outside, I'm just relieved to enjoy anything.
Right, right.
But so now, in terms of the film, it's not a complicated story, but you seem to manage to cover, as I said in the intro, just about everything to professors who are has-beens, to people who want to be artists, to people that get away with murder in art, to people, and also just I think the college experience is pretty well documented without the jocks and the standard fare that you see in college movies. Now, when you were making this, what were some of the obstacles that you had to cross?
Well, the main obstacle making any film is getting that thing financed, and you always go through the same headache when you sit there with the financiers or the studio who's ever putting up the money. They give you the same cast list. Okay, if you cast Tom Cruise or Mel Gibson or Harrison Ford or this, here's the 10 same guys. Put them in your film, we'll make the film. Here's the money. And if you can't find a place for them, then if you're fighting for guys like Jim Broadbent, who's like one of the greatest character actors alive, they're not as interested. But of course, that's the type of people I want to work with.
That's unbelievable. He was great in the movie, by the way. And I swear,
fantastic. And so is Malkovich, and they all were. Houston.
It seems to me that you got quite a bit, quite an A-list cast there. I can't believe that they were arguing with you on that.
It makes your life a hell of a lot easier as a director. I'll tell you that. If you get actors of that caliber, you really don't have to do much as a director. They do all the work.
Angelica Houston was great.
Fantastic.
Malkovich, I haven't seen in a while.
He's fantastic in it too.
Yeah, it's so
a
rare.
Little intimidating directing John Malkovich, though. I'll tell you that. He just had this way of, even when he was being very complimentary, if he'd say, "That's a wonderful idea, Terry," you'd always think he's being so sarcastic on some deep level.
I think it'd be intimidating dealing with him in any level.
He was very, very much a gentleman in my presence and very docile to trust me, put himself in my hands, said, "You're the director." And I asked my other producer, who's known him a long time, Leanne Helf, and I said, "This is a little unsettling here. John's just being too cooperative." He said, No, he's like that when he works with a director. He just, he takes the position of actor, not movie star. I said, "Boy, is that a relief."
That's great. Yeah, I thought he was great because it was not as angry as a role as you usually see him. And he played the art teacher who was kind of hanging on to the dream of being an artist himself.
Yep.
Now, Max Minghella, that's Anthony Minghella's son.
That's correct.
Obviously, he looks just like him. He plays the lead. He does look just like him. He just has that little Minghella face. And I thought he did a pretty good job.
Terrific, yeah.
And I thought that, you know, it's a very it is a surprising movie in that it was very familiar to me, but I didn't see where you were going. And I really like the jabs that you took at conceptual art, at art that is empty. Do you think all art is crap?
No, not at all. I mean, my personal taste in art is so unbelievably subjective, which is partially what the film's about. My personal taste runs to art. I like art from like the teens and the 20s largely, although there's stuff I like later, but I haven't liked much since about, you know, since the 70s anyway. I don't like any modern art that I've seen.
Well, Terry Zrygoff, thanks so much for joining us. The film opens May 5th, am I correct?
I have no idea. I heard April 28th, May 5th, I don't know.
In the next few weeks, Art School Confidential, and I'm not going to give away any of the movies, but there's a lot of surprises in it, and I really appreciate you joining me today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
Okay, take care, Terry. We will be back in just a few minutes. We've got a lot of stuff coming up today. We've got a pretty full show. As I said, we've got from the Band of Brothers, the political support organization for veterans running for Congress, Mike Lyon will be with us. And later in the show, Mark Cooper from The Nation. And, of course, the Dick of the Day. So stick around. It's the Mark Maron Show.
Now his lens has fungus. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much. You know, we've been talking a lot about a lot of things here on the show, but one of the things I talked about yesterday is that high-level military officers, not high-level, but entering Army officers who come out of West Point, the educated, the best of the best, are starting to get out of the Army at their first opportunity as opposed to staying in the Army. Which means that Army leadership is on a very, you know, on a low level. You know, this is entry-level Army leadership. These are the smart guys are opting out for other options. And I hope one of them is politics, if what our next guest has to say is true. If you haven't heard about Band of Brothers, you will now. No one knows the cost of war like those who have been in one. Band of Brothers is a political organization that has been put together to assist veterans running for Congress. Let me clarify, Democratic congressional candidates. With the tremendous success of Paul Hackett's run for Congress in a red zone in Ohio, even though he didn't win, the desire for the kind of values and truth that veterans bring to the political table on national security issues and war itself is profound and resonates with American people. Mike Lyon, the executive director of Band of Brothers, joins us on the phone. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad you're with us. What propelled you to put this organization together?
Well, my God, I'm a military veteran myself, and I've been a Democratic political consultant for several years, and it was a very natural move for me. And, you know, I'll tell you, just, you know, when I was 18 years old,
yeah,
I joined the military, and some of the people that have made a lasting influence on my life and leaders and whatnot have been for the military, and you know, just seeing these men and women pop up here and there, over the last 6 months, willing to run for office.
A lot of them.
Now, you're looking at 60, 70 plus.
That's amazing, and a lot of them are bringing with them a lot of experience. Now, you call yourself a political consultant, and I tell you, I imagine you are as well. I'm a little wary of that title, given the Democratic political consultants of the past who have really been, you know, not successful and somewhat opportunistic. How do you separate yourself?
Well, I would say this, that, you know, I've worked exclusively on campaigns. You know, I was with Clinton for two campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
I work for Erskine Bowles and Wes Clark, but I've always been outside of Washington in terms of, you know, the guys that charge the $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 per month consulting rates that get nothing done, and we're seeing it with this. I mean, the effort that we have right now is being crippled by political consultants everywhere that are trying to jump in and you know, cripple this thing and make it come out with a watered down message and the whole bit. And, you know, for instance, maybe I'll get a $10,000 invoice from a someone that was supposed to raise money for you that doesn't raise a dime, that, you know, says, by God, you owe us money. And it's just very insulting, and it's very typical of what goes on in Washington these days.
Well, I think what you say, Mike Lyon, executive director of Band of Brothers, is true in that if somebody is just concerned with making the money, then the message becomes polluted. And it seems to me that the Republicans have always been greedy, but they've integrated that into their platform. So with Democrats, it just seems that there hasn't been a collective message, and there's been a lot of opportunistic behavior on behalf of consultants.
Well, we pull ahead of them on just about everything.
That's good.
I mean, you look at the last ABC News poll that came out, and my God, we pull ahead on everything across the board, even on Homeland Security, the war in Iraq, and the whole bit. But you get a group of consultants in D.C. that try to water down the message and tell you to counsel caution and the whole bit, and it becomes a problem. You know, when you start wasting campaign funds and you start wasting, precious time in trying to run off the data that's been delivered to you, and you end up with, what we've come across the last several cycles, nuanced message that doesn't reach anyone.
Yeah, a confused message. So this seems to be a new trend in terms of focusing on veterans, for candidacy in general. Was the momentum, I guess, a lot of it is focused on countering the GOP's claim to being the national security party. What are some of the other platforms you guys are running on as from a vet's point of view?
Well, let me go back to that consultant thing for one point. I mean,
No problem.
I think that what you're looking at is a bunch of consultants that refuse to let any of these candidates get their message through. And the same thing can be said for John Kerry or for Erskine Bowles or anyone that ran in 04. I mean, you just get a bunch of people inside that power structure in Washington that are sucking off campaign funds.
Too many crooks, right?
Yeah, it's too many crooks. And I'll tell you, what comes out the other end is somebody that's well-fed there in Washington, but the rest of the American people are just left with nothing.
That's right.
And what we have here...
Hold that thought, Mike. We've got to take a quick break, and we'll continue this in a minute, and we'll talk about some other stuff. We're talking to Mike Lyon. He's the executive director of Band of Brothers. That's a consulting organization helping veterans run for Congress. So stay with us. It's Mark Maron Show.
Now back to a man who likes to play the oil card, Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim.
You're welcome.
Our guest on the phone is Executive Director of Band of Brothers. That is a political organization that has been put together to assist veterans running for a congressional office. You can go to bandofbrothers2006.org to see who the candidates they are supporting are and just how many veterans are out there who are willing to do this and they want to do it. These are Democratic candidates for congressional office, and I'm talking to Mike Lyon now about the culture of consulting, political consultants within the Democratic Party that have confused the message of the Democratic Party over the last few elections. Now, Mike, what are you doing differently, and what is the message that a lot of these guys, what are the platforms that they're really pushing outside of national security?
Well, I would just say this, that normally, you contribute a dollar, you give a dollar to a consultant. Mm-hmm. When you give a dollar to this thing, we make sure that it reaches the candidates, rather than in an earned media fund, a paid media fund, or whatever. But, we're consultant free at this point. We, recognize this thing as a group of candidates that are going to represent the people. What a novel concept.
Right.
And my God, I mean, we're being beat across the chops every way down the line, just to get this message out. I mean,
we can get the House back, it seems. It seems that we can get the House back. What are we, like 15 seats away from that?
We're 15 seats away, And, you know, that Hackett example tells you that this military resume carries resonance out there. It does. It carries resonance, but, you know, people are going to have to put money behind it. People are going to have to get out there and embrace these candidates, and they're going to have to fall outside the lines of the normal democratic strategy. I mean, the metrics that the party uses all says, well, how much personal wealth do you have, or who do you know, in the party that can supply you with some money, and, you know, do you have $1 million set to go instead of, do you need $1 million to win this race?
So if people go to BandofBrothers2006.org, they can contribute to these candidates, they can see which candidates are running in their area, and get behind these candidates?
Yeah, they can contribute to the PAC, they can contribute directly to the candidate, they can make a difference. But I'm just going to tell you that you know, what we're seeing with the party right now, I mean, every poll out there in America says that the Democrats should win. The party's taking that at face value. I mean, the Republicans have a ace in the hole. I mean, and they're gonna throw some stuff at us. And
like what? What do you see? You don't see you know, we here on the left can go all the way out to the margin on this, and some of us suspect the worst from these Republicans to the point of even questioning whether or not they would allow some sort of minor terrorist activity to occur to shift the message their way. Well, what do you anticipate?
You know, I mean, you can go that far out there as well. But, I mean, you know, you look at any of the major dailies even today, and they're having to stand down on, you know, intelligence that says that they're about to attack Iran. I mean, it's definitely possible that they'll do that midsummer, if not in the next 2 weeks. I mean, no one knows.
I think it would take a veteran to be able to point out that is a complete and utter mistake. And
of course it will. Of course it will. You know, the people that have been there and that have fought in these wars, the people that have put these uniforms on and that have bared the sacrifice. Certainly no. I mean, morale's a tough thing. Morale's a tough thing, even in a peacetime army. You get it over there in an army that is misguided and misdirected, I mean, it's dangerous. And then you start a new war on top of that, it's just awful.
It's crazy. Well, Mike, I'm going to send people to the website. I appreciate you being here. That's Mike Lyon, Executive Director of Band of Brothers. Go to bandofbrothers2006.org to get more information. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
You take care, Mike. I tell you, you know, I think he's absolutely right. This Iranian thing is frightening me, and I'm not going to pretend like I know all the ins and outs of what's going on, but I do know that Seymour Hersh is no slouch.
Well, haven't we already attacked? We've already attacked. We already have soldiers in their training laser sights on the nuclear.
Well, there's been talk. There was talk in the past that we were going to subcontract this out to Israel. We were going to have Israel bomb these nuclear sites and that we were going to sort of have a distance from it. But according to Seymour Hersh, The Washington Post, other sources, there are plans on the table to use low-level bunker-busting nuclear arms to blow out these sites in Iran. They're dishonoring the deadline. They say that they are not going to honor the U.N. resolution to not produce this weapons-grade uranium. They announced today proudly, this is the Iranians announced today proudly, that they were now a member of the nuclear nations. And this is, it feels to me, honestly, if I were to look at it, you look at George Bush, who's saying, that's crazy, all these Republicans are responding, it's crazy, those plans aren't on the table, what do you think, we're nuts, blah, blah, blah. But it looks to me like we're on the verge of almost a Bay of Pigs-like situation, where you have this standoff that people assume is just, you know, okay, we shouldn't attack Iran, we should use diplomacy, we should be able to not make that region more chaotic, but it's not just Iran. Iran is an oil-supplying nation, and now there's all this talk and concern around Iraq and Iran starting to run their petrodollars through euros, through other currencies. That is a tremendous threat to our economy, and also there's a threat to us, you know, I don't like to use the collective us, but there's a threat to the oil resources that we so profusely use without any sort of care whatsoever in this country. But someone else got me on the tip of this idea that China is supplied with most of their oil from Iran. Now, I'm not going to quote anybody on that. This is just something that was put on my head. I know that they do supply some of it. But the idea that if we take actions like this, not only will we destabilize the region, again, even make it more unstable.
Too late.
Right. Yeah. Is that what about standing off? What about a standoff between the United States and China? That scares the hell out of me. And shouldn't it?
Yes, it should.
Am I being crazy, Jim? I mean, we're already.
But, you know, we can't have a standoff between them because we're business partners. You know, we share slave labor.
That's right.
And you got your Nikes from there.
Well, thank God I can feel relieved in the fact that, you know, we at least can rely on them as a marketing friend.
But we are already in Iran, though. I mean, we have already invaded. We already have soldiers or consultants or whatever you want to call them training laser sights on targets. So, you know, the arsenal can hit them correctly, you know?
No, I understand that. I understand that. That's
an invasion. If anybody did that to the U.S., we would be under another state of war on top of three others.
That's all well and good, but it's still not, you know, nuking the sites of nuclear weapon facilities. It's not at that point yet. And if there are advisors or consultants, that can't be a bad sign. But, I mean, the bottom line is, just awareness of this. Let's say Cy Hirsch is right. Let's say that you're right. Let's say that there's no reason to assume that George Bush isn't lying about this. I mean, what does the American people do? What has to happen? This is the weird thing about progressive talk. This is the weird thing about when I talk to you. This is the weird thing about making these truths available, is that they're going to counterspin them, sure. And we're going to sit here and go, well, this is true, this is true, this is true. But still, the best that we can hope for is that in the midterm elections, that something turns around and people wake the hell up. I mean, they've got to be able, the Democrats or the independents, progressives, have got to be able to hijack this national security issue and say, look, this can't be the right thing to do, and move that momentum towards replacing some of these congressmen so we can at least start to impeach the president come 2006.
And we already have a huge 10% lead in the polls.
But I just like...
That's good news, huh?
Sometimes I wonder, I really wonder about how much this serves. When people listen to liberal talk radio, progressive talk radio, I wonder how many people out there take action or just get placated by the anger that they feel when they're listening to the shows, that, hey, this is my brain talking. It feels like thinking to me. I feel mad, and this is why I'm mad. I wonder how much of that translates to actual action. You know, I don't know, but I would hope that a lot of people don't think it's just entertainment. Of course, on our show, we do a little more of the entertaining than usual. As a matter of fact, just me talking about this for this long is sort of a rare thing in terms of the scope of our show.
And me listening this long to you is sort of a rare thing. So
well,
it's a good, it's, you know.
Well, thanks for turning that around.
Do you want to give and take.
Do you want to switch some gears and do a little funny here before we go to a break? Because I just read this, and I actually talk about this in my act a bit, that drug companies are inventing diseases to sell more of their products. And I knew this with depression.
Inventing diseases?
They're inventing them. That means that they are making up syndromes. I remember I saw a sign on the subway in New York that said Zoloft now treats social anxiety disorder. And I'm like, you mean shyness? The thing is why do we need medicine for everything? They invent diseases or syndromes to sell medication. I just got a list from our boys in New York about some of these syndromes that I didn't know about, and I'm not sure what medications they're using to treat these, but budget deficit disorder, which used to be called just being poor.
Yeah.
That apparently is treatable by medication. I don't know if it's covered on your plan. Restless testicles. Have you heard about that? That was just called, it's adolescent sexual frustration, non-clinically referred to as blue balls. Are you familiar?
Restless testicles?
Yeah, restless testicles.
Heard about it.
Have you heard about this? It's a sort of an existential despair and spiritual emptiness that they're now calling a wandering Jew syndrome. Have you heard about that one, the wandering Jew syndrome? Have you?
Heard it.
How about persistent sweats after exercise? That's called, you might have the avian water flu. Did you know that? Anything? Nothing?
That's ridiculous.
Do we have anything?
I can't believe that.
This is from headaches and stupidity that comes from excessive headbanging. It's a system of a Down syndrome. You know about it? Anybody? Nothing? How about this one? Do you have friends who have babies?
Yes, I do.
Do you find them that they're lethargic and distracted and irritable all the time?
And annoying.
Yeah, that's called sudden infant waking syndrome, which is actually not the condition that the kid has. That's what the parents get from having one. Huh?
I hear that. Yeah.
All right. Are we moving right through these? How about this one?
Let's hear some more, yeah.
Do you know about the irritable boss syndrome?
I live it. Irritable boss syndrome.
You know, my buddy Henry Phillips is going to come in here in a little while. He's funny, man.
Yeah.
You know Henry Phillips?
No, I don't. I've never
seen
him.
He's a Texan. He's from Austin. And he does musical comedy, which, for the most part, I would steer away from. because you know what falls under musical comedy, don't you?
Listening to your feelings?
No, song parodies. Bad.
Oh, I love song parodies.
Stop it.
Man, they're the best.
Are you Weird Jim Earl?
Prune Juice.
Hey, yeah, all right, buddy. Well, he's going to come in and do some original songs and talk to Mark Cooper about real things, and he's going to have some real answers. Is that all right?
No, it's okay with me. I want some real answers.
We just sit there for a minute. We'll be right back.
Now, like Iran, he's producing uranium gas. Mark Maron.
Why do you have to tell everybody our secrets? Can't we just have a relationship here? In a few minutes, we're going to have Mark Cooper out here. He writes for the LA Weekly. He writes for the LA Times, The Nation. We're going to talk about Iran, immigration, whatever we get to, the leaky White House. But first, we here at the Mark Maron Show want to make positive contributions to society. So every night we bestow, well, it's not every night, it's some nights, we bestow an honor upon one distinguished citizen whose actions most closely represent those of our esteemed Vice President. Without further ado, we present the Mark Maron Show, Dick of the Day. I got to be honest with you, this might be our first sympathetic dick. I feel bad about this dick. This guy didn't set out to be a dick, but he ended up one. Lee Page, a DEA agent in Florida, was giving a demonstration to a youth group about guns, how to handle guns, the different types of guns, and then how to discharge a gun into your own foot. The video is stunning. Page is waving around a Glock, talking about how dangerous it is and how he's the only one in the room who is professional enough to handle the gun. Then he puts his arms to his sides, he keeps talking, and he blasts a cap into his own foot. You got to watch this video. He didn't even wince. Now, here's where he gets dickish. He doesn't end the lecture. He doesn't acknowledge that he is bleeding or injured or an idiot that should have been disarmed to show kids what's supposed to happen when anyone shoots a gun for no reason in a room full of people. No, he just continues to assume credibility in front of these kids. How Bush-like him. How Cheney-ish. The smoking gun is in his hand, literally, and he starts talking about the incident as if it were planned or understandable, like something in the past. I'm going to quote. He says, "See how that accident happened? It could happen to you, and you could be blown away." And he's standing there bleeding, all right? Okay, so he's got a self-inflicted gunshot wound, and he's justifying it. He's distancing himself from it and integrating it into his presentation as an example of things that can happen if you're not professional like him. And that, my friends, is spin genius right there. When he goes to show them another gun, the kids just start screaming, "No!" And they're trying to run out of the room. Okay, so that's exactly, the voters didn't buy it, people. Now Lee Page is suing because anyone can see the video. If you want, you can go to smokinggun.com. And it has ruined him emotionally and professionally and made him a laughingstock. So for inspirational instant spinning after endangering everyone around him, then trying to profit from it, claiming he was a victim, Lee Page is the Mark Maron Show's Dick of the Day. Did you see that thing?
Yeah, that was amazing. Remember the lead singer of Chicago? This ain't loaded.
Terry Kath?
Blam.
Terry Kath.
That wasn't funny.
No, it wasn't funny.
No.
This it was funny, and I felt bad for him, but I had to make him the dick because I thought he could have made a better example of himself, and I don't know what he could have done, but he could have at least said, did you notice in the video, he keeps talking, and then off to the side to whoever the other adult in the room, he goes, "Yeah, I'm hit." But kids... Yeah, he just says, "I'm hit." But
it's
kids,
like
when you're playing
Clouseau.
With him, I could not believe he just kept going, man. I gotta say, I feel bad about something.
What?
We had a conversation last night, and I was talking about spending time in New Orleans, seeing the damage in New Orleans, and then somehow or another, and I realize this is a profound amount of selfishness on my part, because I was talking about it with somebody else last night. I am ashamed of myself that I spent so much time concerned about my own appetite and fat while I was in New Orleans. Because I realized, last night I'm sitting here talking about this incredible dinner I had, and I did. Because on one level, I thought it was good to hang out with people in New Orleans, to support the local economy, to go out and be part of what New Orleans is and was, despite the fact that there is this horrendous reality there. But I literally, last night I was sitting there going, oh my God, I was reading this list, almost, it wasn't even reading it, I was remembering what I'd eaten for dinner. And you were right. It couldn't have been more indulgent or decadent unless I was a king in a medieval manner.
But that's the way to support New Orleans, by being a glutton.
But no, I had similar commentary when George Bush came out and said what you need to do post 9/11 is go out there and get the economy. Go buy something. Get something between you and your feelings before they lead to questions. And then we're going to have a real problem. But on some level, whether it's being a glutton or not, that is a reality. And whether or not you know how to contribute to actually helping people relocate or what that plan is or how that city's going to unfold, it's not necessarily a responsibility, but I think it is important for people to know that New Orleans is a functioning city. I'm not saying be a glutton, but I am saying that part of how we support each other in this country is going to the place and not being afraid to go there, or not necessarily walking, you know, treating them like I had the distinct feeling after 9/11, the way people treated New Yorkers, that people would come to New York that hated New York, that thought it was a Sodom, just because they saw the city as a victim. And I just think that you can go to New Orleans and you can engage in a good time there with also maintaining the awareness of what has happened. See, I sort of didn't illustrate that enough. I did go there to do a benefit. I didn't just go there to eat and lose $300 at a casino. Do you understand?
Yeah, well, you know, you did something more than Bush did, which is, you know, you went there and ate and sat down with people.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks. Yeah. So I did a little more than the president.
Yes.
We raised $3,000 for the United Way, my friend. $3,000,
wow.
That's not nothing.
Jeez.
That's not nothing.
United Way?
Yeah. Well, you got a problem with them, too?
No.
Is there something wrong with the United Way?
Well, it's got the word United in it.
Do you ever think that maybe your problem...
I don't know what I meant by that, but, you know, I don't like United.
Do you ever think that your problem may be Jim? Do you ever think that, Jim?
Yeah, you're right. Maybe I don't go to the gym enough.
Oh, boy. That was horrendous.
Yeah, well,
I'm just going to let that go. That was...
Go ahead.
Sometimes
I don't
good.
Care. I'm not proud. You think I'm proud?
I think you're getting too comfortable.
I don't have pride.
Yes, you do.
I don't have no pride.
Yes, you do. You have the pride of a bitter, practical person who has just been given the stiff hand all his life. Just been given the jip.
Stiff hand.
I don't know
jip.
What that means.
What a jip!
What a jip!
That's going to be in my tombstone.
We're going to talk to Mark Cooper about real things. Can you behave yourself in a few minutes?
I'll ask him a real question.
What do you want to take over the show? What is it? The Jim Earl Show? Now I'm not going to have these conversations with you on the air.
No, we'll do it off air.
All right. You're an ass, man, and I am tired. I am tired of this crap. Every day I come... Are we still on? Oh, we'll be right back in a second.
Now he's got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Did I tell you about the dessert I had in New Orleans before I lost the
$300? Yeah, what was it, a baked pig brain head thing with face and...
What are you talking about? It was a ricotta cheesecake. What, is there a problem with that? You have a problem with mold, with curdled milk? Is there an issue there about killing mold with you?
I just going to be eating milk at our age.
Oh, my God, you're draining me. Hey, folks. I love you, man. Mark Cooper's columns appear regularly here in the L.A. Weekly and the L.A. Times. He was a contributing editor at The Nation for many years. He has a piece in The Atlantic this month on immigration. You can also read all things Cooper at markcooper.com. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
It's nice to see you. So let's talk with immigration. We'll start with this. It's a serious issue. Obviously, it's completely... captivated and hijacked the cultural dialogue. But it seems to me that the right and the left are divided among themselves, not only on how to legislate around this, but on what is going to happen.
You're looking at a real grassroots movement. People on the right and the left always talk about grassroots mm-hmm. movement. This is a real one.
The real thing.
This is the real thing. It's overtaken. It's overridden both parties. Neither Democrats nor Republicans or conservatives or liberals have been dealing with this issue in any realistic way for the last 20 years. We've reached a critical mass where we have millions of people now who are absolutely integrated into the economy. They have millions of relatives who live here or who are legal.
So that's millions of voters.
It's millions of voters, and you can. It's very easy to gauge here in California. You know, in 1994, 12 years ago, Pete Wilson got elected, reelected to office by riding an anti-immigrant wave, and here we have 12 years later, one of the most conservative presidents we know, a president who's desperate, by the way, to find the issue, and George Bush will not ride. He is refusing to ride the anti-immigrant wave because a sizable faction of the Republican Party finally understands that this constituency, this growing Latino constituency,
yeah,
which is a swing constituency in the Southwest,
yes,
is up for grabs, and the Republican Party does not have a long-term future if it alienates this voting bloc.
Well, I hope for their sake.
I know it's hard for us to accept.
Right, but I guess my question is that's striking me is that there's part of the progressive community that says we have to stick by the books, we have to tell the illegals that are working that they're here that they have to go and that the unions can return and all this.
Well, it depends who you're talking about. The progressive rap is, oh gosh, we got to raise the minimum wage and have unions.
Right.
All these illegal aliens get in the way. Of course, what the progressives have forgotten is that in the last 10 years, the only growth in unions has been among immigrant Latino workers, that the only unions that are growing...
So there's a consensus that can be made with the progressive stance...
These are the progressive workers.
Right. Okay.
These are the progressive workers. In Los Angeles, it was the Latino workers and the service workers that got the livable wage. It is the service employees and the restaurant workers, unions, etc., are the only unions in America that are growing aggressively. Those are in bulk Latino and undocumented Latino workers.
So you're saying that if you allow the laws that are on the books now to function properly and keep the sponsorship programs going, that eventually this will level off?
No, we need to change the laws. What we have now is, I don't want to get too wonky on you,
okay,
but what we currently have in rough numbers, mm-hmm, we have about 1.5 million immigrants per year that come into the United States and are integrated into the economy. The market absorbs 1.5 million. Currently, our immigration system gives visas to about 1 million of them.
Okay.
There's about 500,000 short. Those 500,000 come in illegally. I don't want to oversimplify it, but in simplified terms, what we really need to do is readjust our immigration policy so that it fits our realistic economic needs and say, you know what, we also need these 500,000 people. Instead of making them run through the desert in Arizona and get chased by the Border Patrol and trek through 110-degree weather and perhaps die, only to get a job and then be left alone, why don't we just give them a visa and let them come in and have the job?
But are you saying that certain types of immigrants who are treated properly under the law are entitled to a certain wage, and the people that are secondary immigrants should be entitled to a different wage?
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm not for any different wage. On the contrary. As it is, this sector of the workforce is so vibrant that even as illegals, they've been able to unionize. It's pretty astounding.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm for saying let's recognize that they really do work for us, that our economy really needs them, that we have an aging workforce, that we have a more educated workforce, that we cannot fill these jobs without them because we can't.
Well, how do you address the issue of the accusation that they lower the minimum wage?
Well, you know, it's very simple. First of all, they don't lower the minimum wage. They put downward pressure on wages.
Okay.
Even the most virulent kind of anti-immigrant activists, they come up with this figure that it's caused about an 8% drop of wages in the lower ranges. I don't know if that's true or not, but let's accept that figure.
Right.
But I'm an old-fashioned, sorry to break this to you, I'm an old-fashioned internationalist, and from a progressive point of view, if the cost of getting subsistence jobs for 6 or 7 million Mexicans who otherwise would not be able to support their families, if the cost of giving jobs to 7 million Mexicans is an 8% fall in one sector of our wage scale, that's a very small price to
pay. We can take the hit.
Because the real issue here,
yeah,
which everybody ignores, and this is what I write about in The Atlantic, it really doesn't matter what you do.
Okay.
Matters not. And the reason is that what we're watching is a biblical, I want to really stress this, a biblical scale exodus of people from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're really watching.
Mm-hmm.
And when you lay down a border of 2,000 miles that separates the wealthiest country in the world from a country where people can't eat and where the wage differential is approximately 15 to 1, doesn't matter what you do. Visas, no visas, walls, spikes, sensors, people are going to come because they have to.
So you're saying that the kind of ultra-right-wing, isolationist, jingoistic, racist approach is going to fail for whoever's taking
it? Well,
it
has failed magnificently for the last 20 years because every measure that has tried to crack down, all it's really done is increase the levels of illegal immigrants here, because as the borders become more fortified and more policed, and it has, it makes it harder for people to go back and forth. So the Mexicans who get here stay here.
Got it.
So they're coming.
So let's shift to Iran now. Seymour Hersh has reported that moves are being made by the Pentagon to, at the extreme, to prepare for a small-scale nuclear attack on these installations that are producing enriched uranium. Now, my big question is...
Am I for or against nukes?
Right. Well, there's that, but there's also... Someone hit me to this idea that this could be instigating some sort of tension between us and China. Do mm-hmm. you know about that? Do you see that as a possibility? Are we at some sort of Bay of Pigs moment with this?
I don't think so,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that... first of all, I think that Seymour Hersh is probably on to something in the sense that these options were under discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But but to give the military a break, all options are always under discussion.
Okay.
Politically... I think it would be a very, very high-risk move.
A disaster. How could it not be a disaster?
Well, I tend to agree with you, and I think the administration knows that.
Yeah.
When you get desperate, you do desperate things. And the good part, here's the good part. Bush is a lame duck. He doesn't have to get reelected.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican congressmen have to think about getting reelected in 2006. They can read the polls the same way that we all have today, and they're all disastrous for the Republicans, apart from the real-life consequences, which would be disastrous, of a military strike in Iran. I don't think the American people have the stomach for that.
Well, do you get the sense that this particular administration, these neocon guys, don't really care? That it seems to me they are willing to take risks that will put anything at stake just to make sure that they consolidate the power around this oil resource.
True. That's true, and I can't predict what they will do. All I can say is that strategy has backfired for them because, as you know, we have to, those of us who have opposed George Bush,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we can't be all dark. We have to celebrate the poll numbers that we're looking at today.
38 today,
yeah,
right?
The administration 38%. Of George W. Bush has failed. That's in the past tense. It's failed.
Yes.
It's failed. It's highly unpopular. Censure Schmencer. He's already been censured by the
people. Yeah.
Right? So, Republicans, I was at a big Republican movement gathering last month.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you there that was open. I mean, it wasn't a secret gathering. And I want to tell you that the level of dissent among Republicans, of public dissent, was very high.
Well, it's clear because he's saying what he's saying to hold on to this 31% of delusional idiots to make sure they have that.
Right, and you have all kinds of Republicans,
right.
Both moderate Republicans mm-hmm. who are kind of reasonable, and even very conservative Republicans who are very angry with him over other issues like the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
They want to run from this guy, so I don't think that he has the political base or support to carry out an adventure like the one we're talking about in Iran.
Well, let's
do it anyway, so.
Yeah, well, that's what frightens me. Let's talk in a minute with Mark Cooper from his piece in The Atlantic this month on immigration. You can also go to markcooper.com. Let's talk about the Scooter Libby setup in just a second, so stay with us. It's the Mark Maron Show.
Now he's got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Did I tell you about the dessert I had in New Orleans before I lost the $300?
Yeah, what was it, a baked pig brain head thing with face and.
What are you talking about? It was a ricotta cheesecake. What is there a problem with that? You have a problem with mold, with curdled milk? Is there an issue there about killing mold with you?
We just shouldn't be eating milk at our age.
Oh, my God, you're draining me. Hey, folks. I love you, man. Mark Cooper's columns appear regularly here in the L.A. Weekly and the L.A. Times. He was a contributing editor at The Nation for many years. He has a piece in The Atlantic this month on immigration. You can also read all things Cooper at markcooper.com. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
It's nice to see you. So let's talk with immigration. We'll start with this. It's a serious issue. Obviously, it's completely captivated and hijacked the cultural dialogue. But it seems to me that the right and the left are divided among themselves, not only on how to legislate around this, but on going to happen.
You're looking at a real grassroots movement. People on the right and the left always talk about grassroots movement. This is a real one.
The real thing.
This is the real thing. It's overridden both parties. Neither Democrats nor Republicans or conservatives or liberals have been dealing with this issue in any realistic way for the last 20 years. We've reached a critical mass where we have millions of people now who are absolutely integrated into the economy. They have millions of relatives who live here who are legal.
So that's millions of voters.
It's millions of voters, and you can. It's very easy to gauge here in California. You know, in 1994, 12 years ago, Pete Wilson got reelected to office by riding an anti-immigrant wave, and here we have 12 years later, one of the most conservative presidents we know. A president who's desperate, by the way, to find the issue, and George Bush will not ride. He is refusing to ride the anti-immigrant wave because a sizable faction of the Republican Party finally understands that this constituency, this growing Latino constituency, which is a swing constituency in the Southwest, is up for grabs, and the Republican Party does not have a long-term future if it alienates this voting bloc.
Well, I hope for their sake.
I know it's hard for us to accept.
Right, but I guess my question is that's striking me is that there's part of the progressive community that says we have to stick by the books. We have to tell the illegals that are working that they're here illegally that they have to go and that the unions can return and all this.
Well, the progressive it depends who you're talking about. The progressive rap is, oh gosh, we got to raise the minimum wage and have unions.
Right.
All these illegal aliens get in the way. Of course, what the progressives have forgotten is that in the last 10 years, the only growth in unions has been among immigrant Latino workers, that the only unions that are growing.
So there's a consensus that can be made with the progressive stance.
These are the progressive workers.
Right. Okay.
These are the progressive workers. In Los Angeles, it was the Latino workers and the service workers that got the livable wage. It is the service employees and the restaurant workers, unions, et cetera, are the only unions in America that are growing aggressively. Those are in bulk Latino and undocumented Latino workers.
So you're saying that if you allow the laws that are on the books now to function properly and keep this sponsorship programs going, that eventually this will level off?
No, we need to change the laws. What we have now is, I don't want to get too wonky on you, but what we currently have in rough numbers, we have about 1.5 million immigrants per year that come into the United States and are integrated into the economy. The market absorbs 1.5 million. Currently, our immigration system gives visas to about 1 million of them.
Okay.
There's about 500,000 short. Those 500,000 come in illegally. I don't want to oversimplify it, but in simplified terms, what we really need to do is readjust our immigration policy so that it fits our realistic economic needs and say, you know what, we also need these 500,000 people. Instead of making them run through the desert in Arizona and get chased by the Border Patrol and trek through 110-degree weather and perhaps die, only to get a job and then be left alone, why don't we just give them a visa and let them come in and have the job?
But are you saying that certain types of immigrants who are treated properly under the law are entitled to a certain wage and the people that are secondary immigrants should be entitled to a different wage?
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm not for any different wage. On the contrary, as it is, this sector of the workforce is so vibrant that even as illegals, they've been able to unionize. That's pretty astounding.
Yeah.
Okay? So I'm for saying let's recognize that they really do work for us, that our economy really needs them, that we have an aging workforce, that we have a more educated workforce, that we cannot fill these jobs without them because we can't.
Well, how do you address the issue of the accusation that that they lower the minimum wage?
Well, you know, it's very simple. First of all, they don't lower the minimum wage. They put downward pressure on wages.
Okay.
Even the most virulent kind of anti-immigrant activists, they come up with this figure that it's caused about an 8% drop of wages in the lower ranges. I don't know if that's true or not, but let's accept that figure.
Right.
But I'm an old-fashioned, sorry to break this to you, I'm an old-fashioned internationalist, and from a progressive point of view, if the cost of getting subsistence jobs for 6 or 7 million Mexicans who otherwise would not be able to support their families, if the cost of giving jobs to 7 million Mexicans is an 8% fall in one sector of our wage scale, that's a very small price.
We can
pay.
Take the hit.
Because the real issue here,
yeah,
which everybody ignores, and this is what I write about in The Atlantic, it really doesn't matter what you do.
Okay.
It matters not. And the reason is that what we're watching is a biblical, I want to really stress this, a biblical scale exodus of people from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're really watching.
Mm-hmm.
And when you lay down a border of 2,000 miles that separates the wealthiest country in the world from a country where people can't eat and where the wage differential is approximately 15 to 1, doesn't matter what you do. Visas, no visas, walls, spikes, sensors, people are going to come because they have to.
So you're saying that the kind of ultra-right-wing, isolationist, jingoistic, racist approach is going to fail for whoever's taking
it. Well,
it
has failed magnificently for the last 20 years because every measure that has tried to crack down, all it's really done is increase the levels of illegal immigrants here, because as the borders become more fortified and more policed, and it has, it makes it harder for people to go back and forth. So the Mexicans who get here stay here.
Got it.
So they're coming.
So let's shift to Iran now. Seymour Hersh has reported that moves are being made by the Pentagon to, at the extreme, to prepare for a small-scale nuclear attack on these installations that are producing enriched uranium. Now, my big question is...
Am I for or against nukes?
Right. Well, there's that, but there's also... Someone hit me to this idea that this could be instigating some sort of tension between us and China. Do you know about that? Do you see that as a possibility? Are we at some sort of Bay of Pigs moment with this?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that... first of all, I think that Seymour Hersh is probably on to something in the sense that these options were under discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But but to give the military a break, all options are always under discussion.
Okay.
Politically... I think it would be a very, very high-risk move.
A disaster. How could it not be a disaster?
Well,
I
tend to agree with you, and yeah. I think the administration knows that.
Yeah.
You know, when you get desperate, you do desperate things. And the good part, here's the good part. Bush is a lame duck. He doesn't have to get reelected.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican congressmen have to think about getting reelected in 2006. They can read the polls the same way that we all have today, and they're all disastrous for the Republicans, apart from the real-life consequences, which would be disastrous, of a military strike in Iran. I don't think the American people have the stomach for that.
Well, do you get the sense that this particular administration, these neocon guys, don't really care? That it seems to me they are willing to take risks that will put anything at stake just to make sure that they
right.
they consolidate
well,
the power around this
well,
oil
that's
resource.
True. That's true, and I can't predict what they
right.
will do. All I can say is that strategy has backfired for them because, as you know, we have to, those of us who have opposed George Bush,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we can't be all dark. We have to celebrate the poll numbers that we're looking at today.
38 today,
yeah,
right?
George, the administration 38%. Of George W. Bush has failed. That's in the past tense. It's failed.
Yes.
It's failed. It's highly unpopular. Censure Schmencer. He's already been censured by the
people.
By the people.
Yeah.
Right? So Republicans, I was at a big Republican movement gathering last month,
yeah.
And I want to tell you there that was open. I mean, it wasn't a secret gathering. And I want to tell you that the level of dissent among Republicans, of public dissent, was very high.
Well, it's clear because he's saying what he's saying to hold on to this 31% of delusional idiots to make sure they have that.
Right, and you have all kinds of Republicans,
right.
Both moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. who are kind of reasonable, and even very conservative Republicans who are very angry with him over other issues like the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
They want to run from this guy, so I don't think that he has the political base or support to carry out an adventure like the one we're talking about in Iran.
Well, let's
do it anyway, so.
Yeah, well, that's what frightens me. Let's talk in a minute with Mark Cooper from his piece in The Atlantic this month on immigration. You can also go to markcooper.com. Let's talk about the Scooter Libby setup in just a second, so stay with us. It's the Mark Maron Show.
Now back to a man who's building his own private rocket, Mark Maron.
Oh, thank God, it's almost done. Yeah. You want to go? We can do the show from up there.
Get your uranium enriched.
Is that part of the mission to Mars?
Yeah, yeah, sure is. We can syndicate anytime.
He's going to crash into Mars.
Our guest is Mark Cooper. You can see his stuff at markcooper.com. He's in the Atlantic Monthly this month, frequently in the L.A. Times and in the L.A. Weekly. We were talking about immigration. Now, you say you have a solution, Mark?
Well, you know, I know what went wrong.
What's that?
You know, when they put the border, when the guys who put the border down,
yeah.
They put it too close to Mexico. Should put it up near Oregon.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Nobody wants to go up
and
there.
And also, the Indians had a really bad immigration policy.
Yeah.
They really let the wrong people in.
That's for sure.
I have a question. Yeah. You say that that sector, the voting sector, is heavily unionized. Does that mean they're going to, how are they going to vote?
No. The Latino sector is heavily unionized. What I'm saying is that what union growth there is now in America in terms of is basically based on Latino immigrants.
Right.
So that's that issue. And then secondarily, Latino voters, that is citizens, already constitute swing constituencies. I can name you three states: New Mexico and Colorado. Mm. Those three states are swing states. They get decided by narrow margins,
mm-hmm.
They're carried by Latino voters. Man, you know, the Republicans now for 2006, 2008, they're already in trouble just in those because of those three states.
Okay. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah.
It's getting exciting. So I just want to get to the bottom of this, and maybe you can flesh it out for me. Last week, federal prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald delivered some briefs to the grand jury, basically saying that Scooter Libby said that Cheney and Bush okayed the leak of selected classified intelligence material from the National Intelligence Estimate. But from my understanding, the law says that Bush can only declassify stuff if it originated in the executive branch, and this stuff originated at the CIA, so it means it has to go through a review that might not have happened. I guess my big question is, did he break the law? Is he now a conspirator? Can he be tried for treason? Can we impeach him on this?
Yes, yes, yes. I'll see you later.
Okay.
These are legal fine points, and I'm not dodging the question.
Okay.
I don't think they matter.
Okay.
Because the political damage is
been
worse.
Done. Yeah.
Right. And this is really, and you know, impeachment, all these things, in the end, those are political issues.
Mm-hmm.
You want to impeach any president.
It'd be very satisfying, though.
Yeah, I understand. But you can impeach any president you want on a high crime or misdemeanor because they all break laws
of
some sort or another, right?
Right.
And that's a political decision. So the politics of this are very damaging because, you know, as soon as this Valerie Plame stuff broke,
mm-hmm.
Bush was saying, oh, gosh, you know, I want to find the guy who leaked it. And all the time he was looking at the guy in the mirror when he was shaving.
Sure,
right?
Exactly.
It was like he leaked it.
And it's weird. How did Cheney get in the mirror? But, you know, he can do that because he's evil.
Right. Well, he was sitting on Bush's shoulder.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right. Well, I mean, Bush has been caught, if you will, red-handed, just saying one absurd thing and doing quite another. Mm-hmm. And what he did, whether it's legal or not, it's kind of dirty. And not only is it dirty pool, and we're used to that in politics, it speaks to the broader issue of trying to sell this war to the American people on
crap, based on crap.
Yeah, on flimsy or hyped or exaggerated or non-existent evidence.
Right.
So you know that in that NIE report that's at the center of this, there was some suggestion on the one hand that the Iraqis were involved in nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction generation. Mm-hmm. And then there was other information at the same report that said, but maybe not really and probably shouldn't go to war with them, right?
Right.
So not only did he leak what he said he didn't leak, he only leaked what he wanted to leak
and
left out all the good parts.
And in retrospect, what he leaked was a lot of crap anyways, and it was untrue to begin with. But I guess the real question comes down is, I think what people really want to know and want to believe, and I think it's okay if they believe it, that these guys in the White House Iraq group and the Inner Sanctum in the White House sat down and made a decision to take this guy down by doing this.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm going to come back to what we said earlier, because I have my own personal obsessions.
Yeah.
And it's like, we don't even have to ask these questions, Mark. We all have to look at the poll numbers.
Yeah.
He's lost the confidence of the American people on every single issue, including this last one of trustworthiness, which is key. So the real issue to me, I mean, I hate to be, this is my personal crusade.
Sure.
The real issue to me is no longer George Bush.
It's like, can the Democrats can get
it. It's like, what are we going to vote for?
Right?
You know, and are you going to tell me the Democrats will be better than Republicans? Yeah, probably marginally.
Right.
But, you know, then what?
Yeah. Well, there's got to be some hope. I'm just hoping. I'm getting tired of waiting around. But, you know, when I hear Russ Feingold talk, when I hear even Al Gore, I'm hoping we'll get into the race later on. I don't know when he's going to do it, but I think he's going to wait, and I think he's going to do it. But with Feingold and Gore setting a tone, I hope that sort of pervades a little bit.
Yeah. Well, clearly there's that. And, you know, I've said many times, the worst part for me of George W. Bush, the worst part of these last 5 or 6 years is the free ride it's given the Democrats.
Yeah. Come on.
What I mean by that, I'm not being funny about that.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is not that they've had such a great time or that they've exercised so much power, gotten so many perks.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really placed them out of scrutiny.
We've been
so obsessed with denouncing all of the crimes and misdemeanors of the Bush administration, we forget we got a whole other party out there that needs a lot of work.
All right. Well, hopefully that'll happen. Mark Cooper, thanks for being with us. You can see Mark's work at markcooper.com this month in the Atlantic Weekly, the Atlantic Monthly, and the LA Weekly always in the LA Times. Can we do this again sometime?
Anytime.
Thanks a lot, Mark Cooper. We'll be back with Henry Phillips to do some songs and some funny, so stay with us.
He hates his freedoms. Mark Maron.
No, man, you're misunderstanding something, Jim. I hate you, Jim. I hate you.
But you hate my freedoms?
No, Jim, I hate...
You
I
hate my freedom to
I,
be me.
I actually, to be honest with you, I've actually started to like you a little bit. I think we're becoming friends. And a lot of people don't realize
that. How long have we known each other?
Well,
on this intimate level.
What do you mean? We've only known each other like this since we began this show. Literally, we started this show because you and I were forced to leave New York. By a similar momentum.
By fate.
By fate. And it brought us together because you needed a job, and apparently it was my responsibility to take care of you.
If I were a woman.
Yeah? If I were a carpenter?
If I were a woman, how would it be now between you and I, do you think?
Creepy.
You'd love it.
I don't know.
I know, man. You love fighting.
Well, you do dye your hair, which I think is a plus. Not going to respond.
I'm scrappy. I'd be a scrappy female and have good legs. Okay, let's just leave it at that.
It's getting a little weird, man. I had a picture all that, and now I'm like lost in some weird, I don't know what. All right, look, I think the first time I saw Henry Phillips was actually on a Sunday night in the basement lounge of the Ramada Inn on Vermont. Here in Los Angeles, we were doing what has come to be known as one of the worst shows on the planet for a comic to perform on. But if you are in the L.A. area, by all means, go down Sunday nights to the Ramada Inn on Vermont in the basement, and you will see a travesty. It's weird because dozens of comics go down there every week just for some sort of baptism in humility. I actually had to stop, man. Well, Henry, how are you, man?
I'm doing great.
I had to stop going down there because it was literally, no matter what we say as comics, it was too painful.
I know. Well, you know, I don't know if you knew this, but I actually started that whole thing. I was talking to a guy
it was
a bar,
you?
In a dive bar.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't get to take credit for anything that happens in L.A., so let me at least have the Ramada.
No, it. It's all yours.
But so, anyway, yeah, this guy was like, hey, man, I got this room. Do you want to do a show? And I was like, okay. And so I'd go down. I invited a few of my friends, and, you know, I mean, some of my favorite comics.
Yeah.
And they would come down. At least two of them thought about quitting comedy on the way out. They were like, you know what? I'm no good at this. This is stupid.
There's something about
black
that
hole.
Room.
It's a black hole. It's like all the laughter gets sucked up. But
you can bomb in other rooms, but for some reason that room, I mean, the place seats about 12 people. And usually you cajole maybe three or four hotel guests. And then there's just 15 comics in the back chomping at the bit to get on to fail in front of their friends.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's a weird dynamic.
Or just completely berate the hotel guests. That's another. A good one that happened a couple of times.
I like to go down there and berate the host. Paul Hughes is one of the funnest guys to berate. When I saw you, though, you were playing piano. Your guitar, I think, is the instrument of choice. This
yeah.
is now which this is your second CD or
my
third?
My third. Yeah, it's just out recently. It's called Why Haven't I Heard From You, and it's my tribute to failed relationships.
I've had one of those or two of those.
Yeah,
I'm in a good one now, thank God.
Yeah,
how you doing?
I'm going through a breakup right now. Which sucks, and I mean, my friends are tired of hearing me complain about it. It's been 7 years, but it sucks when it happens. And you met that girl about when
in Austin, Houston,
in Houston. Yeah. No, but wow, that's terrible. Are you on in Houston?
We can be on in Houston. It all depends on who's sitting at their computer and what part of the world. So
yeah.
We're probably on in Houston for one or two people.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well,
I know I got fans in Austin.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But she won't know.
All right. Good. But it's just basically I was dating this. Oh, that was bad.
No, you're right.
I was dating a girl recently. Was cool. And tell me your opinion on this because.
Yeah.
And she didn't think this was bizarre at all. And I said, that's the most ridiculous thing. But basically, like, I have no problem if you're in the middle of, you know, making love or whatever. And at one point, the girl says, I really like it when you do this.
Yes. Yeah.
This girl, kid you not, she was always like, about a lot of things, she'd be like, well, I really like it when people do. And it's like, I like it when people do. And I'm like, can you stop saying people? That's not the right word at all. It's not even like gender specific. You just picture a big crowd of people, you know, at the DMV or something like that. And and then she was like, well, that's, you know, you're just being weird. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to go up on stage and I'm going to talk about that and just tell me what you think. And then, you know, 300 people laughed at her at that point, which is the nice reward
about doing comedy.
Yeah. Yeah,
to be able to go, see, huh? Who's the weirdo?
See, everybody hates you.
Yeah, you yeah. Personalize that a little bit. All right, so, yeah, I that people's a little much. Does she say, at least say your name now?
Well, no, we don't see each other anymore.
Oh,
but,
I'm sorry to bring it up again. Jeez. So this first tune is going to be from the new record?
Well, no, actually, this is, I'm the worst self-promoter in the world, so why don't I do a song that's not on the new album that I'm trying to promote. This is one of the first songs that I ever wrote, and I wrote it back in college. And it's a nice little bouncy, you know, there's enough garbage going out there, you know, traffic-wise and stuff for people. Well, maybe not right now, but, well, yeah. I figured I'd do something a little bit light, and this is just a song that I wrote for a girl. It's funny, because when I first met this girl, she didn't speak a word of English,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't speak, you know, whatever language she spoke or whatever. But it's, you know, it's a nice, innocent song. And I wrote it for her on her 15th birthday. And I'm going to go ahead and share it with everybody. I'm joking about that part of it, I should say. All right, here we go. You are the blossom, I am the vine. You are the blossom, I am the vine. Sweet little blossom of mine, hanging on the vine. Extracting all the nutrients from inside, sweet little blossom of mine. You are the oyster, I am the pearl. You are the oyster, I am the pearl. Sweet little oyster of mine, irritating you inside, covering me with your shiny mucus-like substance until I shine. Sweet little oyster of mine. I am the host organism. You are the unicellular dinoflagellate algae. I am the host organism. You are the unicellular dinoflagellate algae. Sweet little unicellular dinoflagellate algae of mine. Letting me use your chloroplast that I can photosynthesize. Providing me with carbon in exchange from the nutrients you obtain from my catabolic pathways. Sweet little unicellular dinoflagellate algae of mine. Come on, guys, sing along with me. Here we go. I am the Ozzy Osbourne. You are the Sharon. I am the Ozzy. You are the Sharon. Sweet little Sharon of mine. Right there by my side. Pulling my bloated cocaine and methadone and barbiturate saturated body out of the bathtub to keep me from drowning in a puddle of my own vomit. Sweet little Sharon of mine.
Henry Phillips, go to henryphillips.com. Get all the Henry Phillips CDs. So that's very touching, man.
It's an amoeba, too. I just dropped him off at Amoeba this morning.
You did?
Because, yeah, you told me I was doing the show, and so I was like, were great. I pulled them out of I had two of them in my jacket, and I woke up right on the street corner there anyway, so it was fine. No, I'm just,
You could just do that, because no stores carry mine. It's very hard to listen to our show and also to get my CDs. I try to make it as difficult as possible for people to have access to what I do, because I think that makes you special.
Absolutely.
You can just go to Amoeba and drop things.
You got to play hard to get.
Did you really just go?
No, I really did. Yeah, well, they had had them there before, and I guess maybe the first time you have like a rigmarole. But it was just like I had three of them in my jacket, and I gave him two of them, and the guy's like, "All right, cool." And then he gives me like $14 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm giving some personal business practices of them on the air, but anyway.
Sorry.
So I was like, "Well, I have a third one too," and he's like, "No. We got plenty." But I'm like, "All right, well, if I have my jacket, if you need another one." But I was thinking to myself, like, does Sony do this? Is this how they get their stuff into the stores?
Oh yeah, that's exactly how they do. They get a guy who made the record walk around with a box, going, "Hey, dude, can you just take a couple of these? You got to do that song for me, or my wife will be pissed off."
Yeah.
And I think Zach, my producer, Bill Kohler's kid will like this song. I think it's around his age group, isn't it?
Okay,
12,
yeah.
13, 14?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Well, this is, I want to, I'm having a little bit of trouble here. I had broken a string, and I put, for any guitar players out there, I know you play, and I have an electric D string on an acoustic guitar because I had to pull off.
I noticed that. I heard that in the,
yeah, so, but in a way, I like it because it's sort of like I have this acoustic kind of James Taylor thing going on, but there's one string in there that rocks.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah,
it's kind of cool. But this song does not rock in the traditional sense, but I travel a lot, as you know, and then I was at this club in called the Funny Farm in Roswell, Georgia, which is terrible. And are we on there too? Crap. I got to stop saying
that. No, you can do it, everyone.
Okay, yeah. No. It's
a
great club. It's just the fact that I was there wasn't the good part. But the whole... Oh, I'm babbling. I'm just going to go into the song. But this is a song about, I don't know. When I was a kid, I was teased a lot. I used to eat a lot of pizza, and the kids started calling me Pizza Face somewhere in my mid-teens. And I think it was because I ate a lot of pizza. I don't know. But this is a song about why it's more important now than it ever has been for us to be nice to each other, especially if you're in high school. He's the kid in the back of the class who always keeps to himself, and the other kids call him Quasimodo, 'cause he got some hunch upon his back, and his hair's all filled with crap, and he only wears a trench coat, and instead of taking notes, he draws pictures of Satan. But please don't laugh at him, don't even crack a joke, don't blow your spit wads in his face or pee in his coke, 'cause someday he might come to school with a snub-nosed 38, and if you're nice to him, then just maybe he won't kill you. And if you see the fat kid walking through the halls, and he's got plaid pants, don't say, hey, look, everybody, looks like someone stole my couch. And just because the weird guy throws a baseball just like a little girl doesn't mean he doesn't know how to make a bomb. All the film freaks and the drama geeks and the people with braces and the pizza faces and the four eyes, let's not treat them with scorn. Cause someday they'll find the combination to their grandfather's gun collection, and they'll form a militia and make you wish you had never been born. And when you're cowered under your desk someday, you can flash them a little smile and say, remember me, I was that dude who said hello to you once in a while. Maybe then he'll pause and say, well, you know, I guess that's true. And then instead he'll bump off the guy right next to you. So next time you want to pick on a nerd, please choose a jock instead. Cause I'd rather go home with my underwear all up my ass and with a stomach pumped full of lead. And especially be extra kind to the kids in the science club, cause they're the ones who know about nitroglycerine. And if we're nice to them, then maybe we'll just get along.
Henry Phillips, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming, man.
I make that like my theme song, but it's like
great. It's a beaut. Go to henryphillips.com, get the records. We'll have you back again sometime,
Thank
man.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You bet. Stay with
it.
Us. We've got the short order news coming up.
Well, all that's about to change, maybe, because Mark Maron's short order news is coming up next. Now his stage name used to be Parker Ukarkas, Mark Maron.
What? Now I don't even understand what you're talking about. What a great show it's been, man. It feels like it was action-packed. We had it all, man. Terry Zwigoff, we had Mike Lyon, we had Mark Cooper, we had Henry Phillips in here. Tomorrow we got Tony Hendra, the author, very funny guy, one of the original Lampoon guys. But right now, a lot of you, look, there's been a lot of news today, and we here at the Mark Maron Show don't want you to be caught off guard. We want you to be well informed. So here today is the second edition of the Mark Maron Short Order News. NASA plans to crash a space probe into the moon in 2009, a collision so violent it will be visible on Earth through a telescope. With this project, NASA is looking to the future of space exploration while harnessing its proven ability to crash into things. In Wisconsin, a 25-year-old man convicted of stealing hundreds of pairs of underwear was sentenced on Friday to 1 year in jail for his second conviction of stealing panties. In his own defense, the man testified that he didn't think of them as underwear. He thinks of them as hats. President Bush's job rating is at a new low. According to the latest Washington Post ABC News poll, 38% of the public approve of the job Bush is doing. Bush himself isn't worried, however, because the next terror attack isn't staged to happen until his numbers get in the 20s. That's the Mark Maron short order news for today. Okay, Jim? Is that okay with you?
Yeah, that's fine, man.
Are you all right with
that? I fully approve.
I got to go to the gym, man. I got to go to the gym, Jim. I'm in one of those weird, it's been like 3 days. I haven't gone since I left New Orleans.
Which gym do you go to?
I go to the YMCA. I'm old school, my friend. Old school. Go to the Y.
I just don't want to go to the exact one. What if we're in the same place and we see each other coming semi-nude? That would be very embarrassing.
Look, dude,
and tension-filled.
I'll be honest with you. I take it all off in the locker room. I'm not afraid. I'll walk around with nothing on in the locker room. This is a big jump for me, my friend. Because I was one of those guys, I didn't like to be naked around anybody in a locker room situation when I was in high school. I was very self-conscious. Mm. I was afraid of it. But now, I don't care. I don't know if that's age or the fact that I'm becoming gay. I'm not sure which one it is.
I had a 5-year excuse from PE.
You did?
Yeah.
Just for being a...
I had a fake ankle injury.
Were you a bitter guy? Were you a bitter young person, too? Were you...
I'm very hopeful, just like I'm very hopeful now. I was a very optimistic, hopeful person.
You know what? If you want to temper that with some reality, you should go to the Y and go to the locker room of a YMCA and see the arc of age and what that has to do to a person's body, man. I see there are men wandering around that locker room that must be 90, and I just got to be honest with you, and I can't say this enough, it doesn't end well for anybody.
I've seen old people naked. Barry and I used to write...
Barry, your old partner in your comedy team, Lank and Earl, from the day?
Right. We used to write 976 numbers for Penthouse, and our specialty was for old people.
Go ahead, lay it out.
And fat people.
Well, are you going to do some? You just set up a classic old Lank and Earl bit.
No, it wasn't Lank and Earl. It was for real. We get paid like $30 to $50 a page, 30-second script, and we got fired very early for that.
For doing something funny, right? This is leading to something funny, right?
No. We just got fired because we were very bad at it.
That wasn't a setup for anything?
No, it was for real.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah,
you know what's amazing about radio is just how much time you can waste of somebody's mind and evening. You know, that's what I love about it. It's a great medium like that, is that sometimes you're really sharing important information with people and you're leading them down a path and you're saying, hey, we all got to get together on this and everyone's got to know the truth.
Right.
Other times you're just blathering because you have nothing better to say and you're literally, in an entertaining way, just wasting people's time. Did you ever think of that, Jim? Take a second to think about it.
What?
Exactly. It's wild. Because right there, that's a few seconds that people are not going to get back.
That's called timing.
Yep.
That's called timing.
What?
Don't be afraid of empty space.
Excuse me? What? I'm not
old people.
Yeah. Was that going to be funny? Are you still?
No, it's for real.
Were you teasing a punchline?
It was a real story. I was opening up to you, and you attacked me for it.
I can't.
I sense a pattern here.
Oh man, look, we're on the verge of war with China. Do you think I'm going to, take any of this to heart? Do you think I'm going to, worry about this? Tomorrow I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to thank the heavens.
Thank God?
No.
The heavens?
I'm not going to thank God.
Takes a village. Start in your own village to change the world.
Wait, I was just going to say something important. Is that the music to go already? Oh man, I was just going to, I had some very important things to tell people, and I guess it's going to have to wait till tomorrow. When we have Tony Hendron, who's very funny. He's got a new book about the second coming of Jesus. Playwright Mark Morris is going to be here.
Oh,
you're planning on doing something funny?
Damn straight.
All right. Well, we'll see you tomorrow, sheeple. Sweep tight.